Hello, I'm Jennifer Vine, President and CEO of the Education Foundation of Sarasota County and your host for Education Conversations, a discussion forum to share innovative and relevant thoughts, research, and ideas on education today and to explore ways we can help prepare students to thrive. Welcome to this episode of Education Conversations, Ensuring Opportunities for All Students. There is a lot of recent talk about school choice, and with that, I have seen both confusion and misinterpretation of what this might mean. While school choice isn't recent or new, it is definitely evolving. This was under a movement that began back under Governor Jeb Bush and one that has remained a top priority of Governor Ron DeSantis. School choice means many things to different people. So as opposed to offering a blanket definition, we thought it would be helpful to address some of the overarching questions associated with it, such as how are students and families benefiting? Is anyone being left behind? What resources are available and to whom? How do families access these resources? And all leading up to, how do we ensure opportunities for all students? Questions like these are top of mind for my guest today, Doug Tuthill, the president of Step Up for Students, a position he has held since 2008. With its mission to empower families to pursue and engage in the most appropriate learning options for their children, Step Up for Students is an organization that advocates for school choice and provides scholarships to students and their families so that they can access the education and resources that meet their unique needs. Doug brings extensive and diverse experience to his work, and he has taught at the high school and college level and has served as a teacher union president. He has an undergraduate and master's degree from the University of Florida. I am so excited to have Doug join us today, and I'm sure many of our listeners are eager to hear from him. So without further ado, Doug, welcome to Education Conversations.
Thank you, Jennifer. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I am too. So let's start by just kind of painting a historical picture of how this all started. How would you frame this discussion? And what is the reason why we have seen legislation like this exist? Why does it matter?
Well, in Florida, actually, the choice movement started in the late 70s, early 80s with our magnet schools. And today, the greatest number of kids participate in the choice programs are actually in magnet schools. Also in Florida, over half the kids attend a school other than their zoned neighborhood school. So I like the term education choice because the choices are actually today, we'll get into this, I think, are beyond schools. But it's certainly become the norm in Florida that families are looking at all kinds of different options to figure out how do I craft a learning environment for my child that best meets the unique needs of each child. You know, at Step Up, we like to use the word customization. Mm-hmm. It's something that's happening throughout our society. It's becoming a norm, you know, in society that all kinds of things are available to us that we can customize. And now we're in a situation where we're looking to how do you help families customize an education that meets the unique needs of each child.
That is really terrific. And you are so right in that we are living in a world where I think when I was growing up, it was black coffee and do you want cream or sugar with it? And now you can get every version of a hot or cold iced latte, right. Et cetera, et cetera. So you really do raise that point. But how do we know that we can entrust taxpayer dollars to the families making those decisions? Or how do we know they're making good decisions on behalf of their kids and that we're going to have a better educated community as a result of those choices?
Well, as you know, as a society, we have historically invested public dollars in parenting. I know when I was raising my two boys and I did my taxes every year, there was all kinds of subsidies for childcare and things like that in the tax code. I know Congress recently, it's not in place anymore, but had a $3,000 payment to families for each child. And so there's a long history of us investing in parenting and investing in children. I think what we're seeing at Step Up, and you mentioned the growth, this year we're going to serve probably about 375,000 students. If our nonprofit was a school district, we'd be the largest school district in Florida. We're actually going to be bigger than Miami-Dade and probably the fourth or fifth largest school district in the country. But I also understand that raising a child is very complex, and finding the right educational choices for a child at any one point in development is also really complex. And so one of the things that we're working on as the choice movement expands And of course, people are voting with their feet. So mm-hmm. clearly families are saying, look, I need an option that's going to be the best for my particular child. A lot of the families that we serve at Step Up are low-income families. Over 75% of our children that we serve are minority children. A lot of these families are trying to break the cycle of generational poverty. They know education is the key to getting out of that situation. But we also know that we need to help them make really good decisions. And so the key to that is good information. And so we're putting in place a lot of infrastructure that allows families to access all kinds of different information, both about the various kinds of educational providers they're looking at, also getting feedback from other families, because we know from our polling data that families get most of their information from other families. And this is the area where social media has been really helpful. There's mm-hmm. a lot of networking going on amongst families, sharing information. So anyway, I understand that's going to be really important to provide good information to families to help them make good choices for each individual child. And that's a big part of the future of the education choice movement in Florida.
And with the expansion of House Bill 1 in July, this went beyond just school choice. This is giving opportunity and to additional educational opportunities to help lift up those students. So can you expand a little bit more on what are some of those available resources?
Yeah, I've been on a crusade recently to move from school choice to education choice as the term, because it really is much broader than just schools. For example, we have about 80,000 kids who qualify what we call special needs or unique abilities. These are kids with spina bifida, Down syndrome, autism. And for a lot of these children, they need a very different kind of environment and different kinds of services. A lot of the kids need a lot of physical therapy, occupational therapy. The autistic kids particularly have all kinds of different kind of needs. And there's all kinds of different interventions that are really helpful for those children. So we try to make sure that there's a whole portfolio of different kinds of educational options, learning options for families. Like I mentioned, physical therapy, occupational therapy, after-school tutoring, summer programs, virtual programs, as well as traditional brick-and-mortar programs. There's a lot of innovation, Jennifer, that's happening right now out in the field. There's going to be almost $3 billion in spending that's controlled by families in Florida this year in education spending. And that's causing all kinds of educators to create all kinds of innovative options. We have a school that is done primarily in the Ocala National Forest. So the kids spend a lot of time in nature. You can learn a lot from biology and everything else, you know, math. And so there's a lot of innovation happening. And so our job then is to make sure that families have the information they need and the support they need to find the best option for each individual child. And my sense of working with these families over the years is they are very passionate about their children and their children's education, and they're doing everything possible to get their kids out of a situation that doesn't work for them. Nobody in this business is for or against any kind of school. I'm not in the business of public school versus private school. You mentioned before I was a public school teacher union leader for years. Mm-hmm. I'm not in a situation where I'm going to say this is good and this is bad. But what I do believe is that what works for one child doesn't work for another. I'd like to say that Harvard is a failing school for some children. It just is. Mm-hmm. Every school on the planet is a failing institution for somebody. It's all about the matching. And so you want to make sure that you match the child with the school that best meets their needs or the other kind of learning environments, whether it's an after-school program, whether it's a summer program, whether it's any kind of other learning opportunities for them. And so that's really part of the work, is making sure that we have all these options available for families and give them the information to help them make really good choices.
I think that's a really enlightening perspective, because it sounds like you're really being student-centered as opposed to system-obliged, if you will.
Yeah, it's interesting. The politics of this is sort of a different conversation. Mm-hmm. People are debating about, is it the right testing system, or, you know, how is this funding going to affect this program over here or that program over here? And from my perspective, it really is, let's build a public education system that starts with the unique needs of every child and then go from there, as opposed to this institution has been around for 200 years. We need to protect that institution. Well, let's make sure that institution is serving the needs of the students in the best, most effective and efficient way possible. And just a different way of looking at it. I think it's easy for people to get caught up in looking at it from a systems perspective as opposed to looking at it from a kid's perspective.
Right. And so just for the listeners who may not know, it's roughly about $8,000, right, that a family can receive?
Yeah, if you're, there's different programs. The kids with unique abilities, sometimes that's more. Like I said, some of those kids have deep end needs, spina mm-hmm. bifida, Down syndrome, et cetera. So sometimes that average scholarship for those unique abilities kids is about $10,500. but some of them could go up to $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, depending on how severe the child's situation is. But a kid who's not in that special needs or unique abilities bucket, the rest of the kids, it's about $8,000 a year.
How does one actually go about accessing that? Because I don't think Step Up for Students is the only provider, but I think you are the statewide leader in this work. So can you give a little bit of explanation of how a family would find you or any of those resources?
Yeah, about 99% of the kids on scholarship are through Step Up. They would go to our website, stepupforstudents.org, and they would apply. We have a variety of different programs, so they would pick the program that best meets their kids' needs. We actually have scholarship programs that are only for kids in school districts. Kids who are in K-5 who struggles in math and reading, we have scholarships for them. We also have transportation scholarships for kids in school districts who are attending the school that is outside of their community. So the family would go to us and say, this is the kind of scholarship that's the best fit for my child. We would qualify them, and after we qualify them, we would notify the state that this child, Jennifer is qualified for a scholarship. We would tell the state what kind of category she fits in. The state would then send us the money, and we would create an account just for Jennifer. And that money would be in that account for you, for example, if you're the student. And then you and your family could spend that money on a variety of approved services or products. And we have a purchasing guide that's available. We know that we're spending tax dollars, so we're very conscious about protecting the public good, making sure those dollars are spent appropriately. But we're also conscious of the fact that kids have very unique needs. We've been criticized, for example, for allowing some children to buy big screen TVs. But if you're partially blind, you need a big screen TV or a big screen monitor. Or if you're a homeschool co-op and you have 8 or 9 kids in your co-op, you need a larger screen. So it's easy to criticize purchases if you don't understand the unique needs of the child or the environment. But we try to do that. We try to look at the needs of the kids. The state also gives us some guidance as to what they think the parameters ought to be, the guardrails within which spending ought to occur. And then we go back, and we have a lot of educators on our staff. We oftentimes will sit down with a family and talk about a child's particular needs and then make sure that a particular purchase is appropriate. I'll give you a funny story, the local paper in St. Pete, Tampa Bay Times, wrote a piece, and they were criticizing us for letting kids have paddle boards. But it turns out that so many kids with unique abilities or special needs are doing physical therapy on paddle boards that they actually made it a new event in Special Olympics. Hmm. So unless you understand the context, it turns out if you fall off a paddle board in the water, it's less painful than if you fall over on the ground. So you can understand. I mean, for large motor skills, it makes a lot of sense. Sure. In terms of balance and everything like that. So again, from the outside, sometimes people don't understand why we approve certain purchases. But from our perspective, we have to understand the unique needs of each child in that family while protecting the public good and making sure the public dollars are spent appropriately.
That's great. That's a really terrific explanation. And then just to play devil's advocate a little bit, because again, everyone's seeking to understand and they don't fully know all the different components. If I were to be the adversary here of saying, well, what is it doing? Then what is the unintended consequence that is happening to the public schools as they increasingly lose more funding from what many would say is already underfunded? What would be your response or framing of how we should view that in context?
Well, first we have evidence, which is helpful. Independent researchers have found that in those communities where a lot of kids go on scholarship and opt out of the local district school, the academic achievement in those district schools goes up. The reason it does, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of our kids are low-income kids. The average family of 4 in our program makes about $40,000 a year. When you have a high concentration of poverty in a school, it's harder for teachers to meet the needs of every child in that school. When you reduce the concentration of poverty, it makes it easier to meet the needs of the entire population. So we are reducing the concentration of poverty in a lot of high-poverty schools in Florida, which helps everybody. In addition, there's a competition effect. So in those communities where they're starting to see some kids make different choices, the district school is saying, wait a minute, maybe we should listen to our customers. They're voting with their feet. Let's check in with their customers and say, families, what can we do to better meet your needs? That's happening all over the state of Florida. There's a lot of innovation happening in school districts. So that competition effect is also helping the district schools. The thing that's important is that our scholarships are about half of what it costs to educate a kid in a school district. So you mentioned that's about $8,000 for a kid who doesn't have unique abilities. The average school district spends at least $16,000 just for the direct service to the kids. That's not counting capital funding or debt funding. So you're getting 50 cents on the dollar. The kids that come into our program are the highest poverty, lowest performing kids in the state. That makes sense because if you're happy with your kid and it's in the school they're in, why would you go out to make a change? So it's people whose kids are not succeeding in this particular school that go to get a scholarship and try to make a change. So those kids, when they come under our program, they're underperforming. But once they get into the program and they're tested by law every year, they keep up with all kids nationally academically, which is not the norm. Usually every year that a high poverty kid is in school, they go down in terms of their achievement relative to the general population. But we reverse that trend, and we do it for 50 cents on the dollar. People ask me, what's the magic sauce? And I really think it's about choice and empowerment and ownership. You know the old saying, nobody ever washed a rental car before they returned it. And what I see in this program is that the families who apply have a great sense of ownership over their kids' education. And when you own something, you're more likely to invest in it emotionally. And so that's what I'm seeing is that kind of investment. I'll tell you a quick story. It happens to me a couple times a year, and I'll try not to get overly emotional as I tell the story. A couple times a year, I'll have a grandmother stop me. I'm in a Publix or wherever, and they'll tear up and they'll say, look, my grandchild was headed in a really difficult direction. You know, I was worried about gangs. I was worried about teenage pregnancy. Didn't want to go to school, was failing everything. I got him in a scholarship. I got him in a school, my local community, where everybody knew my grandchild. He's turned around totally. You know, he went from Fs to making As and Bs. He's excited to go to school. His manners are better. His self-control is better. Everything is better. And I'm so inspired by him. I had to drop out of school in ninth grade to work and support my family. I'm going back to get my GED because I want to be a good role model for my grandchild. That's about hope. Mm-hmm. You know, when people are hopeless, you don't try because it's hopeless. But when you have hope and you start to see that, okay, I can really change the direction of my family, I can change the direction of my children and grandchildren, that hope is contagious. Hopelessness is contagious, but also hope is contagious. And that's the most beautiful thing about this work, is you see hope spreading in communities and families that didn't have hope before. And that's just transformational. And I think that's the beautiful thing about empowering people and that sense of ownership that we're seeing through these programs.
That was a really good story, and that certainly has a lot of inspiration and provides hope to others. But what is the real motivation behind that? What are we trying to solve? Why is choice and all of this, as you have increased the numbers of students being served, why is that so?
Well, first of all, people are voting with their feet. No one's forcing them to get the scholarships. But I do think we as a society in a democracy have an obligation to do everything we can to provide equality of opportunity for development. People are our most valuable asset. And we have an obligation to invest in people and do it in a way that's going to allow them to realize their full potential. And I think that's what's really happening here. I'm very respectful of what public education has done over the last two centuries. I mentioned earlier before we started the show, I was raised in a segregated community in St. Petersburg. My high school wasn't desegregated racially until my junior year. So I saw the effects of Jim Crow. I saw the effects of inequality. And that's frankly what's motivated me throughout my career. And I'm now 68 years old. So I've been doing this work since I was 22. But I think that that's our obligation as a society to make sure that we build systems that allow every human being the dignity of developing their full potential. That's probably an aspirational goal that certainly will never happen during my lifetime, but it's the right aspirational goal to have. And that's part of what we're doing now, is we're trying to transform public education in such a way that it makes the promise of equal opportunity more real for more people.
And through your longstanding career in doing this, do you look back and have any, thoughts of you missed the mark on something, or if you could do it all over again, would you create something different? Would it look different than where we are today? Or do you find that this model is the right path to go in?
It took me probably 25 years to figure out that what I was doing wasn't working. And so in reflection, I didn't appreciate the fact that the system was dramatically underutilizing the human capital, and I had to change the whole system. And that's sort of what I'm trying to do now. people say you're trying to destroy public education. That's the opposite of what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to create a public education system that fulfills the original promise of delivering equality of opportunity. And money is critical, because what I learned over the years in school districts is that every decision is a political decision in a school district. That's just natural. And the most valuable asset is teaching quality. And when you allocate teacher quality in a school district, you're going to allocate that resource in a way that's very politically influenced. And so people who don't have political power in school districts oftentimes don't get that most valuable asset allocated to them. I can tell you, as a teacher union leader, I could say the job of a really weak teacher, and we put that teacher back in the classroom. We didn't put that teacher back in the classroom of parents who had a lot of political power. Like the president of Chamber of Commerce, they didn't get the weakest teachers. It was those kids who from low-income communities where the families didn't have a lot of political clout. Those are the folks that got the weakest teachers. And ironically enough, those are the folks who needed the very best teachers. And so I struggled for 15 years in my teacher union role trying to figure out how do I reallocate power to the people who don't have it so that it's a level playing field. And I said, I woke up one day and said, well, money is power. What if they controlled their money, their education dollars? That would change the whole dynamic. And that's exactly what's happening. Now, some people are unhappy with that. but at the end of the day, we're giving power to people that historically haven't had that power. And dramatic change is happening because of the redistribution of that power. And I, you know, there's lots of landmines we have to navigate through this process to make sure that it's a win-win for everybody. But we're committed to doing that. And at the moment, I'm pretty happy with the momentum that we have today.
That's really terrific. And then knowing that you're coming from a place of passion, you're definitely trying to give hope to those. You want to see stronger equality and better outcomes for all kids. What still needs to happen? What are some of the imperfections in the development and evolution of all of this work that we should be paying attention to going forward?
For 200 years, we've had a top-down command and control, you know, public education system. All the decisions were basically centralized. And now we're saying we want to decentralize a lot of those decision makings, but we want to do it in a way that's going to be effective and efficient and protect the public good. I can tell you it's really complex. It's very, very complex. And we're early in the process, and we're still working through how to build a decentralized public education system that's organized around customization, that protects the public good from financial distribution of money. But how do you do that in a way that's not overly bureaucratic? It's because you want to be flexible, but you don't want to be too flexible. I talked about customization, but you can go too far with that. So everything's moderation in all things, but building systems to go to scale. We're going to approve scholarships for about 450,000 kids this year. Now, because of lack of space, we're probably going to end up having 375,000 or so of those kids actually use those scholarships. But that's a big population to communicate with. And all the information that the parents need to get through the application process, how am I going to spend my money, how much money is available to me, there's a lot of things you have to work through. Now, in a top-down organization where you don't have to make any decisions because somebody's making all the decisions for you, that's the positive side of that. The downside is that it's one-size-fits-all decision-making, and so you're not meeting the needs of all kinds of kids, particularly those who need education the most. So I think the biggest challenge right now is just complexity. This is going to sound like a strange example, but I'm old enough to remember when the Berlin Wall fell down. Mm. And East Germany was a top-down command and control organization, economy, and people didn't like it. That's why they had a Berlin Wall, because they were trying to keep people from escaping. But just taking down the Berlin Wall didn't create paradise in East Germany. There was an enormous amount of work, and they're still doing it. Billions and billions of dollars to build new infrastructure, to create new ways of work. It's just a huge endeavor to go from a top-down command and control organization. And you saw what happened in the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union broke up, it was chaos. And today we're seeing the results of that chaos. You know, it's a country that's really has great assets available to it, but it's really poorly managed. It never made that transition. It's a mess. And so I don't want to replicate any of those examples. But when you change a top-down command and control system, which controlled people's lives and their decision-makings for decades or not centuries, and then suddenly you say, okay, we're gonna go to a more democratic kind of system, that is really complex. There's values, there's norms, there's systems, there's habits. It's a lot. And so that's what we're working through right now.
I would agree with you. That's a very adaptive problem that takes a lot of unique perspectives coming in on that and a patient approach, because I think your analogy actually is spot on. I hate to admit, but I too remember when the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Union changed and all of that. And that was Cold War ended in the 90s. And there's still many of those countries are still finding their way. So I think you are saying we're playing the long game. And yet, at the same time, we still have to make sure we roll up our sleeves. And so accept the imperfections are there. But if we all can at least agree on the shared values of what we're aiming for, we probably have a greater chance for success. Is that fair?
Yeah. And that's why I always start off with equality of opportunity. Very few people disagree with that. And in customization, very few people look around and say, well, customization is not important. When I was a kid growing up, we only had three TV stations, and now, you know, there's a lot more.
Yeah.
And people have, you know, there's all kinds of aspects of our lives that are very much customized. I mean, we're doing a podcast now, which is basically because of the breaking up of the media historically. Now you can customize your media and Jennifer and Doug can do a podcast. Whereas, you know, when we were kids growing up, there was radio stations, but there was no such thing. So there's all these different opportunities that are out there, but managing it in a way that's going to be effective and efficient is a bear.
Well, I really applaud, like I said, the passion that you're bringing to this and your longstanding dedication to helping lift up all the kids, particularly in the state of Florida. So really kudos to you on that. I know for me and the Education Foundation, we sit there and we look at, you know, since 1981 and when President Reagan, you know, stated we were a nation at risk. And that for me was in my own childhood, and I've seen incremental change, that it is time to really give that hard look. So you're doing some hard work. It definitely is not perfect. It certainly comes with some war wounds for sure. But I think if we can continue to work together in caring conversations about the shared values, I think that's a really good place for us to be. So do you have any final comments or anything that I might have missed that you want to share with the listeners today?
No, you did a great job. I would just say that I think all of us are united in believing in equality of opportunity. All of us are united in believing that, you know, our most valuable asset is people, and that we have a moral obligation to do everything humanly possible to let every human being develop themselves to their fullest potential. And so I think in that sense, we're all on the same page. I think, you know, change of this magnitude is always going to be difficult. It's always going to create some pushback. You know, we live in a very polarized time right now politically. You know, we're very tribal as a species, and people, you know, break off into their tribes. So that adds complexity, but I'm optimistic. You know, I'm optimistic we're heading in the right direction. And I'm excited about the possibility of a public education system that's dramatically better than the one that certainly I went through as a kid.
That's terrific. Well, Doug, where can families go again? Tell us again where they can go to get more information to learn about how to access these wonderful resources that are available to them.
They should come to stepupforstudents.org, and that's our website, and all kinds of information is available there. And we're happy to do everything we can to help people and serve them the best way possible.
That's great. Well, I am so honored to have you here today coming down and sharing your wisdom and insights, and certainly all the hard work and accomplishments you all are endeavoring in. And so listeners, if you want to learn more about the Education Foundation, as I know you will probably also learn about Step Up for Students and how we at the Education Foundation support students and teachers, you can visit us at our website at edfoundationsrq.org. And we really appreciate you all listening today to today's podcast. And if you like it, be sure to leave a review and tell your friends, and be sure to tune in to our other episodes of Education Conversations. For now, this is Jennifer Vine signing off for the Education Foundation of Sarasota County.